This is Fresh Air. Rob Nilsson's new movie, Chalk, stars homeless and formerly homeless people from San Francisco's Tenderloin District. You can't see it yet, it just wrapped a couple of nights ago. Nilsson has been running an acting workshop for homeless people for close to 2 years called TAG, the Tenderloin Action Group. This is a new turn in a career of low-budget independent films. His first film, Northern Lights, won a prize at the 1979 Cannes Film Festival. Hollywood wasn't necessarily his goal, but neither was Skid Row. He went there to research a screenplay about a homeless veteran. While trying to get backing for that film, Hope for the Fourth Ace, he ended up forming TAG and making his new film, Chalk, about pool hustlers. There was a reason he wanted to write about a homeless person. His brother had been one.
The initial impetus to go down to the Tenderloin and live in one of those hotels and try to know who the folks were that I saw on the streets and had seen for so many years was because my brother had been missing for many years. He would show up from time to time, and there'd be a phone call from time to time from a mental hospital here or jail here or there that my father would get. But we really didn't know where he was for, I don't know, it's up to as many as 10 years. So I got an idea for a screenplay, not based on his life, because I really didn't know what his life had become, but a life of a homeless Vietnam veteran and a lottery ticket. So I went down to the Tenderloin and to learn about the streets and to write that screenplay.
Is that where you ended up finding your brother?
No, my brother had been found right around that time. He had called my dad. He had been picked up off the street some 3 years before by a sympathetic ex-social worker who saw something in him and liked him, got him cleaned up. All his teeth had fallen out, and got him some medical care, got him on to SSI and his Medi-Cal. And so then Greg had stayed with him for a couple of years and then contacted the family. So I went down to Santa Monica where he was living and found him there right around the same time that we were beginning this whole thing.
So did he come back with you to the Tenderloin?
Oh, Greg's in the film. I mean, Greg has now, he and I are together and in my house, and he's working on the film. He's been a member of the workshop. His life will continue to change and evolve. I mean, in many ways, he remains, his most comfortable area is the streets, and to be out in the streets panhandling. And even though he lives with me, he feels most kinship with the folks that he knows out there.
What was his problem? Was it drugs, mental illness? How did he end up on the streets?
Mental illness, yes, and also a lot of LSD back then when people were doing that. He did LSD almost every day for a summer. But he is diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and it was probably chicken and egg, right? Was the drug first? I don't know much about schizophrenia, but it all seemed to happen around the same time.
The Tenderloin Action Group has a credo, and I want to just read some of it. It says, "I am not to be defined by my problem at the expense of my creative talents. I'm not an alcoholic, drug addict who sings, writes poetry, paints, makes films, makes music, etc. I am an artistic human being who has problems, but I'm not alone. We all do, and substance abuse is only one of them." Did you write this credo?
No, that was written by a man who came to us, really a highly talented, educated guy who had been a school teacher and came from a family a musical family, who had been a saxophone player, really brilliant guy, who had I don't know how many year bout with heroin addiction. And we groomed him to be the lead in the film. And unfortunately, he was not able to stay off heroin. And a week and a half before we were to go on, he went back on it, and we felt that it was too risky for the production. So we had then to go out and recruit another actor who, by that time, it was too late to find anyone from the streets. So we have an excellent, I mean, more than excellent, really a great actor from San Francisco named Kelvin Han Yi, who is an actor who, with a lot of experience, he was in The Great Wall, for example, and ACT stuff, who has come in to play that part.
Well, I think you've just hit on one of the problems that you're likely to be up against if you're working with people who are homeless, that some of them are users and might go back on, and others might not have the discipline to keep up with it. How much of this have you run into?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the first week, the week and a half before we started to shoot, we lost our lead actor. Another of the leads went on a bender and almost died, collapsed in front of the warehouse. It was either withdrawal problems or whatever, but he also, his heart isn't that great, and he collapsed in front of the warehouse. The paramedics came, brought him to the hospital. He spent a week in there. We didn't know. We thought there's another role we'd have to recast. But he recovered, and he came in, and he has done, I think, just incredible and very surprising work for a man who, up until a year and a half ago, had never acted in his life. But towards the end of the production, it happened again, and off he went. We had to scour Portrero Hill. We went running around looking for him. You know, there we were on the set waiting for him to show up, and he had been missing for 4 or 5 days, but we found him, cleaned him up, brought him down to the warehouse, and brought him under the lights, and it was so hot he collapsed, hit the floor, went back to the hospital. But a couple days later, he came out, and as I say, we finished the film 2 days ago with him there, and we're trying to, he's now living with us in the warehouse. We're trying to do everything we can to get him situated so he can not only move along with us in the workshop, because this isn't just a one film deal as far as I'm concerned. I want to keep going with this until we finish Hope for the Fourth Ace and beyond, but we want to get him some employment and get him stabilized and then back to it. So yes, I mean, it has happened enough times for me to know that it probably always will happen.
Doesn't this make you part director, part social worker?
Well, I resist that idea. I just feel that I've met some people who have taught me a lot about stuff. I wanted to know who lived on the streets of America, and I went out, and these folks gave me, without reservation, stuff from their lives, and the lives that they've lived have been amazing lives. So I just think we're some folks that came together and we did this. And no, it's not social work, but it's some friends now. Mm-hmm. And they helped me, and if I were to go under or go down or something to happen to me, they'd be there. And I'll be there for them.
My guest is filmmaker Rob Nilsson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Rob Nilsson. He's the founder of the Tenderloin Action Group, which runs acting workshops for the homeless. What do you like about working with people who aren't trained actors?
Well, I don't like acting. You know, the problem always with actors is if their training isn't right, particularly for film, is they're always trying to convince you. You know, they're always trying to act, to embellish, to do too much. I just like being, and you know, acting is not real life, but it's real emotion in an artificial situation. And I find that non-actors are sometimes can get closer to that idea. What we're looking for is real human stuff here. Then there are technical aspects of projecting yourself into another person's skin, but with film anyway, almost always you find that it's very close to a kind of typecasting. There are only very few actors. I'd say John Voight is one, for example, but I think there's only a very, very few actors that are not really themselves in almost every role. You know, Rupert Pupkin, for example, with De Niro, was certainly a different character, but almost always De Niro is De Niro, and there's not that much transformation, in my opinion. And so why should we expect it from non-actors? They come forward, they understand that there is another person here, but they're giving forth from their own life, and when you're homeless, you're pretty close to all you have is your own life. And so that the rawness, the realness of the emotion and the feeling sometimes is very close to the surface.
Can you give us a capsule of the story of Chalk?
Well, yeah, that's a little hard. It's a bit serpentine, but it concerns a family that runs a pool hall in Richmond, California. And it concerns two brothers, one the blood brother of the owner, who is a son that he had with a Korean woman when he was in the Korean War, and who he abandoned along with the woman when he left Korea. And the other is an adopted son. And, of course, the first son is African-American, and Korean, and the second son is Chinese, a young kid that he adopted when he saw when his parents were killed in Richmond, and he saw that this kid was a pool prodigy, had a natural gift for the game. So the brother from Korea eventually makes his way, looking for his father, into America and finds him, but finds also that he's the dark brother. He's the brother that's not loved, and he's the other brother is the one who's loved more and who is the golden one, who has the skill and who has the talent. So anyway, the two brothers make a team. The Korean black brother goes out and finds marks for the Chinese brother to play back at the Crabtree, which is the name of the pool hall that they have, and then they split the money. And so it all concerns a match that the older brother sets up for the younger brother to play with a known tournament player, but it's really a match that the older brother is setting up that he believes that his younger brother will lose. In a way, it's a kind of a revenge situation. So it's all built around that type of thing. And then the auxiliary characters, the loves and lovers and friends and relatives that hang around in the pool hall.
In 1979, you made a movie called Northern Lights, a feature film that won the Cannes Film Festival Camera d'Or. That's, you know, one of their big prizes. Yeah. I know it played the Art House in Philadelphia. Leonard Maltin includes it in his video guide and describes it as incisive, unforgettable Americana. When you made that film, and it was so well received, were you hoping for the big commercial career?
No, when John Hanson and I made that film, we were hoping to be able to make a career out of making films like that. And at that time, it seemed, that was in 79, it seemed like there was the context that would make that possible. I mean, we had seen Cinema Novo in Brazil, Italian neorealism, the New Wave in France. New Wave means something so different now. Woodfall cinema in Britain or in England. There were groups that formed and little schools that got started where people were telling the stories of real people without this awful three-act screenplay and this kind of terrible storytelling thing that Hollywood has pushed throughout the world, this awful thing that the plot is all. The plot is not all in Aeschylus. I mean, the plot is not all in Sophocles. The plot is not all in the Bible. I mean, there's character there. There's some other passion that gets involved, and we wanted to pursue that passion. But at the time, there was an audience for that. You had an audience that went to see Bergman and Fellini and Pasolini and early Bertolucci and Satyajit Ray and here Cassavetes in this country, Shirley Clarke maybe on the fringes, and now that's all gone.
The film Northern Lights was about Scandinavian farmers in North Dakota before World War I. Does that connect to your family heritage?
In the sense that Norwegians and Swedes, yes, my people came up to northern Wisconsin, and they came there from North Dakota and from Minnesota after initially having come from Norway. And so I was, so ethnically, yes. And my grandfather was the first filmmaker up in North Dakota, really before the Nonpartisan League and before the events that in Northern Lights that informed Northern Lights.
So your grandfather made documentary movies?
Yeah, well, he did. But my grandfather, it was kind of funny. He had a little film company where he'd go into the little towns and he'd try to sort of gild the lily a little bit and, make them look somewhat more prosperous and paint it up than they really were. And then those films would go to Europe to promote immigration. I think probably it was done through the state of North Dakota or whoever. So he wasn't a true documentarian, but he was there photographing the people.
Did that excite you about movies?
No, I didn't like any of it. He had all... He grabbed, my mother had to work for him, and she had to do all this photo tinting, and we had all this equipment in the basement and all these smelly chemicals, and no, I had no interest in it. And it was only I started off as a poet and started off painting, and it was really only much later in life. I didn't get started making films until I was in my 30s, so kind of the family illness didn't strike me till quite a bit later.
What's the next step with Chalk? What kind of distribution do you think it's going to have? Where will it be shown?
Well, when we finish it, it'll go to the festivals. Naturally, try to get it into limelight as much as possible, and then we at the same time start showing it to distributors. But you know, I have to say, Northern Lights, which won at Cannes, was not no distributor would touch it. Heat and Sunlight, which won the grand prize at U.S. Film Festival, nobody would touch it. But we distribute our own films. It's like John Cassavetes, who was a friend and a mentor of mine. He couldn't get the system to do anything for him. And so, okay, I mean, I may sound bitter, but I'm not bitter. I am fighting against a system I don't like. And so we will fight. Hopefully they'll join us. Hopefully they'll say, hey, these people have something, and these films that they've never given people a chance really to see, yeah, they are worthwhile. Northern Lights should be re-released. Let's do it. Let's get behind this effort. But if they don't, we'll be out there. I'm known as the Curtis LeMay of independent distribution, saturation, bombing parking lots, movie parking lots with flyers. We go out all night and do our work. So in the morning, people know that our film is opening in San Francisco or in New York or wherever. And, you know, we back it up with our elbow grease all the way through the procedure. So if we have to distribute this one again, we will. But we've gotten some interest already from some distributors. I'm going to New York tomorrow to talk to a couple of them. And I hope that they'll see that this is something that people are really going to want to see.
Rob Nilsson is the founder of the Tenderloin Action Group in San Francisco and director of the new movie, Chalk. This is Fresh Air.